The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Recently, I've been reading a book that many of you may know. It's Kafka's The Trial. It's the story of a bank executive, Josef K., who awakens one morning to find that he's been arrested for some unknown offense. Kafka's tale centers on the efforts of Josef K. to deal with this completely unexpected development. I haven't gotten very far in the book. Maybe a third of it is under my belt. But something relevant to our Zen practice has caught my eye. Josef K. has been cast in the role of an accused criminal by people and forces unknown to him. Superficially, many things appear to be the same as they always did. But there has been a huge shift in his reality. The comfortable assumptions of order, logic, and predictability that Josef K. had previously used to order his universe have become unreliable. Overnight, the world has become a scary place, and he no longer feels safe. Overnight, reality has changed for Josef K., but Josef K. has not changed overnight. He actively resists change. He reacts to his new role of criminal suspect with a very habitual, familiar, and, it turns out, dangerous response. He rebels against reality. He tries to soothe his feelings of confusion and powerlessness by making noises about his high social position and his professional accomplishments. Ignoring the obvious fact that both his high social position and his professional status have both been completely undermined by the fact that he has been accused of being a criminal. He defends his self-esteem at all costs, despite his drastically changed circumstances. This passage from the book explains where Josef K. is coming from. What a position K. was in, after all, compared to the judge who sat in a garret while he himself had a large office in the bank with a waiting room and could look down upon the busy city through a huge plate glass window. What is reality, and how do we meet reality? Whether we realize it or not, this is a central question that animates our lives. When we aren't getting what we want, and let's face it, that's a lot of the time, we're scheming and plotting to alter reality to suit our tastes. We're looking down on reality through a large plate glass window and thinking we're in charge of what we're looking at. If only reality could wake up and see things the way we see them. But do we look down on reality, or do we look up at reality? The answer depends on our own attitude toward reality. But either way, as Yukio Mishima says in his Thirst for Love, everyone likes to watch a fire, but those who watch it from the terrace are no better than those who watch it from the street. Adjusting our tastes to accord with reality accommodating things as they are is definitely not our go-to response. I don't know about you, but my reflex is to be a lot like Joseph K. My mind is always ready to generate such thoughts as, this can't be happening. This is an outrage. This makes no sense. Don't they know who I am? Well, of course, they don't know who I am, because I don't know who I am. This fact isn't easy to acknowledge, let alone accept as an operating principle of daily living. But the Buddha connected the dots for us thousands of years ago, handing us a method for dealing with our delusions. If we give ourselves to it, and we can do that right here, this practice will help us to deal with our delusions when faced with the ultimate and inescapable facts of life, old age, sickness, and death. On the surface, none of these ultimate facts seems to be at play in the trial. Joseph K. is neither old nor sick, nor does death seem a likely prospect, at least in the beginning of the book where I am. Nevertheless, K. literally wakes up to the essential reality of life, impermanence, which takes the form of his arrest. He's compelled to learn that an arbitrary, hidden, and capricious force beyond his knowledge or control can take everything away from him. Can you relate to that? Does that sound at all like our current situation? Even a little bit, perhaps? What is your reality right now? And what is your relationship to your reality? I think each of us assumes roles to cope with what we perceive to be reality. Often, we take on these roles unconsciously, and our behavior is shaped by whatever role we assume. And that's the point, really. We choose roles that encourage the behavior that makes us as comfortable as possible in the face of a reality that is sometimes so overwhelming that we dare not look it in the face. How did we happen upon the roles that we prefer? In Joseph K.'s case, we can only speculate. He was brought up in a respectable, middle-class household, and that his self-importance and arrogance were the armor with which his loving parents sent him out into the cold, cruel world. Still, this protective armor bequeathed to him by his parents is flimsy and useless. It offers no protection at all. I had a role like Joseph K. I worked in a bank for 12 years. As I rose through the ranks, I was given increasingly large offices, each with a large plate glass window, from which I could look down on the world. But I could not control what I looked at through that window. And one September morning, I looked down and could not find the source of a loud noise that distracted me from my morning routine. Not seeing the cause of the noise below, I looked up. And that is when I saw a jet airplane flying over the Hudson River at an unusual altitude and an unusual course. And I watched the plane until its nose turned north and until it exploded into a building. Then I turned to look at the window on the inside of my office. And there I saw people running, and I ran with them There are so many roles. The rebel, the follower, the loner, the life of the party, the leader and the skeptic, to name just a few. Which role do you prefer? Is the role that you prefer you? Each of us may take on multiple roles, and sometimes simultaneously. For example, the wallflower may take on the helper role to remain invisible in a socially approved manner. We choose roles based on our comfort with them, or based on our discomfort with what they help us to avoid. Our comfort with roles has much more to do with our habits than with whether they benefit us or not. We see this clearly with Joseph K. in the trial, who assumes a role of rebel immediately. In his manifestation of this role, he is arrogant, condescending, hypercritical of everyone he encounters. This seems foolhardy, especially since as an accused criminal, he can use all the friends he can get. Despite his incredibly logic temperament, Joseph K. doesn't understand this. He cannot control himself. He must adopt the role that he is used to at all costs. When a person feels powerless like Joseph K. and compulsively takes on a role to defend himself no matter the cost, we can say, I think, that he is addicted to that role and addicted to the behavior that goes with it. In other words, the person is addicted to an idea of himself. I think addiction to the self is the worst addiction of all. And our culture, which is really the source of this problem, doesn't even recognize it as an addiction. Have you ever met someone whose preferred role feels arrogant, condescending, and hypercritical? The rebel isn't the only role where these behavioral qualities can be exhibited. The expert is another role of this sort. I've long enjoyed taking on the expert role. And I've even designed situations where I could take it on and play the expert to the hilt without fear of retribution. The expert can use knowledge to inflict his or her pathologies on other people. And I must admit, I've made this mistake repeatedly. After years of Zen practice, I finally saw my preference for the expert role. And I saw this behavior that the role allowed me to express and understood that it was behavior that I wanted, and that is why I chose that role. This kind of seeing, although painful, has helped me to relate much more clearly to myself and to affect my behavior toward others. My seeing introduced a space between the thing I call me and the role that this me habitually prefers. The importance of this space cannot be overemphasized. It is the difference between freedom and addiction. It is the difference between freedom and slavery, really. Addiction to a role, addiction to the self. And as everyone who has faced addiction knows, you can't come to terms with an addiction when you don't acknowledge it in the first place. Creating a space where we can look at, acknowledge, and work with our addictions to what we call ourselves is perhaps the most important benefit that this practice can offer us. Sitting on the cushion, working with our teachers, we learn to look steadily and compassionately at ourselves. What are we looking at? We learn to restrain the impulse to judge or analyze what we see, so that we can actually observe what's right there in front of us. As we keep looking, the behavior that our preferred role enables becomes much more transparent and much less automatic. More transparent because we can see the mechanism behind the role, the motivation that causes us to undertake it in the first place. And less automatic because we can actually start to make conscious choices based on what's happening right now, instead of just reflexively taking up the role that we prefer. I call that freedom. Real freedom. Practice in community helps us to examine circumstances, not only from our own point of view and from what might benefit us and make us more comfortable individually, but also in terms of what might benefit others, individually and collectively. With no assurance that we can actually know what choices and behavior will benefit everyone involved, we can nonetheless choose our roles with that in mind. We can stop confusing our interest in surprising ourselves also with some kind of self-improvement campaign. This is not a self-improvement campaign. I really believe that what we're learning to do is to surprise ourselves with ourselves. The more surprises, the better. Although it's fairly easy for me to articulate this to you, applying it in daily living is not so simple. I had an interesting experience of this recently, where I noticed my habitual reflexive behavior and my work here allowed me to intervene in my own behavioral process. So as some of you may know, I accompany immigrants to court hearings and check-ins with an organization called the New Sanctuary Coalition. One of the most prominent features of this accompaniment work is how long it takes. Many of the people we accompany do not have lawyers to represent them, and those who don't have lawyers are always seen last by the immigration courts. So there's a great deal of waiting involved in these accompaniments. Sometimes we sit with these guys in the courtroom, and sometimes we sit with them in the waiting room, waiting to get into the courtroom. But wherever we're waiting, I frequently get up because it's too much to be sitting there for hour after hour on a hard bench. On one recent accompaniment, I got up and went to the hallway. And as I was pacing back and forth, I happened to notice a ladder. The ladder was bolted to the wall and also bolted to the floor. And it extended from the floor to the ceiling. The top of the ladder ended precisely where the ceiling began. Because the ceiling was low, and because the ceiling in that location was exactly the same as it was everywhere else in the hallway, I couldn't imagine what the purpose of that ladder was. It seemed to be a ladder to nowhere. Then I noticed a tag attached to the ladder. The tag showed that the ladder was being regularly inspected. The date of each inspection and the initials of the inspectors were neatly inscribed on the tag. Seeing this, I immediately started ridiculing it in my mind. This is the most absurd thing I've ever seen, I thought. A ladder to nowhere that is being carefully inspected on a monthly basis? How Kafkaesque! I couldn't figure it out. And not knowing anything about that ladder, I decided it was a pointless joke. This is exactly what Joseph K. does in the trial. He treats his process as a joke. He mocks the court at his first appearance, before he knows what he's charged with or what the penalties might be. Although completely ignorant of the facts, he speaks with great conviction as follows. There can be no doubt that behind all the pronouncement of this court, and in my case, behind the arrest and today's inquiry, there exists an extensive organization that not only engages corrupt guards, inane inspectors, and examining magistrates who are at best mediocre. And the purpose of this extensive organization, gentlemen, it consists of arresting innocent people and introducing senseless proceedings against them, which, for the most part, as in my case, go nowhere. It is quite possible, for me, it's quite tempting, to adopt the attitude of Joseph K. toward our country's immigration enforcement procedures. And yet, can you imagine what would happen if an immigrant were to stand up in court and say something like what Joseph K. said just now in this passage? Or if I, as an accompaniment person to this immigrant, stood up and said it? The court would be outraged, and our immigration deportation proceedings would be accelerated considerably. But Joseph K. doesn't understand this in the trial, and neither did I at the first when I saw that ladder, so convinced I was of my own opinion, my own knowledge of what I was looking at. But after my mockery went on for a couple of minutes, all this was going into my head as I was walking back and forth, marveling at it, something dawned on me that was most wondrous and rare. It occurred to me that I had no idea what I was looking at all. I had only my own habitual behavior, my standard biases, my assumptions, my role of expert to go on. And as trivial as the example seems, my realization felt like a real victory for me. I saw that I enjoy using mockery to mask my ignorance. That kind of seeing can be very uncomfortable, but it is invaluable because it helps me to get to the place where I can consciously choose my own behavior. What I'm describing to you, curbing one's addiction to the self, is nothing less than freedom. When we see this way, we can actually become ladders to nowhere. We can completely disappear. And what do I mean by completely disappearing? Complete, uniform, unmixed plainness. Since the top priority of any immigration accompaniment is the safety of the immigrant we're accompanying, I kept my mouth shut about the latter. I didn't make any comments. I didn't speak to the guards about it, who, by the way, are armed. With so many immigrants in danger of deportation, there was no room for mocking any apparent absurdity, whether it had to do with ladders in the hallway or events in the courtroom itself. I just accepted my insight as an added bonus to the accompaniment. In my encounter with the ladder, I was accompanying myself. Returning to the roles that we use to defend ourselves from an uncomfortable reality, I'd like to quote the Italian filmmaker and writer Pier Paolo Pasolini. Pasolini said, "The intellectual's role is to not have any role, to be the living contradiction to every role." I wonder if I can bear to taste that kind of freedom, if I can allow myself to be that exposed, if I can allow myself to be that vulnerable, recognizing again and again that life is not a trial and that I have nothing to defend. Maybe I can creep on all fours just a little bit closer to that place of liberation. It's always waiting, immediately available for you and for me. And I'll close by quoting Prometheus Bound by Aeschylus, just because it's such a cheerful holiday sentiment. I say this to show you how I love them. For they had eyes, and yet they saw not. Ears had they, and they did not hear. But like disjointed images and dreams that have no order or connection, they beheld in the distorted reflex of their vain imaginations all things.